Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And welcome, everybody, to Behind the Curtain. This week, a look at politics and some theater that actually raises some political issues. We're going to get to that. But first, joining me, so happy to have the clerk of Cook County, David Orr, a long-serving clerk. He's decided to retire and not pursue his office again. And so it's a good time to get him to open up and chat about all sorts of things. Former mayor for a week of the city of Chicago. David, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
You bet.
So let me just, first of all, the reason for retiring, is it just enough? Have you had it?
Well, I didn't use the word retire. I said I'm not going to run for re-election.
Okay, fair enough.
I think, I first was elected in 1979, and Jimmy Carter was president. So it's been probably about 38 years in this, you know, wonderful yet corrupt town, Chicago and Cook County. So I just think it's time for me to think about some other things.
Oh, so you might be running for mayor or something.
No, I'm not really suggesting that. There's a lot of other things I could do. I do like my work. I think we've accomplished a lot, but you know, my gut tells me it's time to move on.
By way of kind of reminiscing a little bit, I mean, you've been in this job. It's not like being governor or being mayor, you know, a job that you can understand, or Speaker of the House, that somebody doesn't want to give up for decades at a time. This one seems so administrative, so sort of just keep the ducks in a row. And yet you are so dedicated to this office. I guess I'll just ask you the blunt question. Why do you care so much about this office that's kept you there for 30 plus years?
Well, I never thought I'd be around that long. I left the city council back in 1990, partly because the idea of being an administrator. Remember, I take government seriously, and I'm truly offended by the total right-wing folks who believe government should do nothing, and offended by machine politics that corrupts government. And so I wanted to prove that you could run government successfully. And when we get all these compliments about our website and you get your final records on time and we do good on elections, that's what I think we have to do more of. With the increasing threat to government functioning, even by the latest budget, you know, that we're going to dramatically build up the military, which we don't really need, at the same time cut social programs, what's happened is we don't really have much of a democracy anymore. I take that stuff seriously. You can be in a job for a long time and not do a good job, and you can being a job for a long time, good job. I think a lot of it for us is we accomplished a lot, both efficiency within the office, as well as nearly, I'd say, almost every single piece of electoral reform legislation since 1990 we've been a central part of. So, you know, from early voting to, you know, I could go on online registration, online absentee ballots, mail voting.
And I want to talk about some of those specific.
There's a lot of pluses there.
Yeah, and I want to talk about those parts of your office, but I think it's more fun, you know, the some of this other stuff. Really, it's a great time to have you open up. And when I think about what you just said, the Republicans who, you know, it's all about the money, and the Democrats, you know, seem to have a certain image. But when you come to this world, you're the clerk for Cook County. When you come to Cook County and you come to the city of Chicago, I don't think you get to describe Democrats and Republicans the same way you want to describe them at the national level. I mean, and you talked about machine politics here, man. And you and I have talked about it, a battle going on for what the Democratic Party really is in this city and in this county.
Right. Well, it's been going on for some time. Obviously, we few independents or we few progressives have fought the machine. And I believe people are mistaken if they think the machine is gone. It's not as strong as it once was. But there's enormous power politically. There are all sorts of liberal groups that are not jumping in the most important local race we have, and that's in the assessor's race. They're not jumping in because fear of powerful people whose names I won't mention, but you can guess. Okay?
Yeah.
So, and right now it's really picking up because the battle for assessor and a few other races, you know, our revolution and others, if we can beat what I call the machine here, there's a chance for the Democratic Party to stand for something.
Well, let me, before you go beyond it, because you've said the assessor's race, and you know, you and I don't want this to be inside baseball for folks. You know, sure. Joe Berrios is the current assessor, been there a long time. Lots of accusations about the fact that he hires friends and family to work in the office. That doesn't seem to ever stop. But he says he gets the tax bills out on time. He has garnered not only two opponents, and we'll know soon whether or not there will be two or just one on the ballot, but Fritz Kagi, who is running against him, you've come out in support of, not just you, Congress people, Robin Kelly, Bobby Rush, Danny Davis, progressive alderman Scott Wagaspack, Rick Munoz. What, I mean, this really is, and Berrios, by the way, not only assessor, but of course, chair of the Cook County Democratic Party. You're going after one powerful guy when you support somebody else.
Well, when I first ran for clerk back in 1990, I ran against the chairman of the Illinois Democratic Party, and I won. So I know it can be done, even though it's a tough fight against the old machine. But it's so critical. Remember, part of my job, besides elections and vital records and other things, is taxes, okay? And we, of course, we don't do assessments, but we deal with tax delinquencies, and we set the tax rates for the nearly 1,500 taxing bodies in Cook County. And I'm utterly frustrated and disappointed in the assessor's office. And again, there's a lot of BS going on, and there's going to be a report coming out tomorrow. But the bottom line, now the argument from people who should know better, like Tony Preckwinkle and some of Berrios' people, are, this has been going on for 30 years. No, we're talking about here. Now, there's been shenanigans going on because of the old machine. We're talking about here is that about 8 years ago, Houlihan, as assessor, discovered some problems. Part of it had to do with the collapsing economy. Another one had to do with the legislation. And they realized there was a problem. They started trying to deal with it. In fact, that's when some foundations came in to help. So when Berrios came in nearly 8 years ago, he was given information about this problem. And then he stalled quite a bit. But finally, about 3.5 years ago, these great people worked for him. They came up with a better model. Okay? And so then he announced to the press, bragging about it, that there had been a real serious problem, but he fixed it. Okay?
Right.
My frustration is he didn't fix it because he hires too many hacks as opposed to people who can do the job. Okay? So they couldn't really do the job. And then he blames it on the people that he hired. He hasn't blamed the foundation, Julia Stash and some of those people, but I think he'd probably like to. And so then, because of the Tribune and other series just last year, we discover that he did nothing. This is not 30 years of BS. This is on Joe Berrios, okay? And when you're, and then, of course, he brags about getting tax bills out on time. Now, that's something we all work together on. I don't mind giving some credit, but the problem with getting the tax bills out on time is he doesn't do them right. The office has now admitted they don't reassess property like they're supposed to, like Houlihan did.
Well, that's the report you're talking about. We're waiting for that report to come out shortly.
No, that's different. I'm talking about the facts from the previous reports.
Ah, okay.
Okay? See what I mean? That report will come out tomorrow. What I'm saying is there's been so much BS coming from that office. And I don't particularly like to attack people, but this is really atrocious. And also, he's costing taxpayers millions of dollars. We have a multimillion-dollar lawsuit against the Cook County because of this. There's another big lawsuit coming. Okay, and this is no way to run government. So that's why I've kind of taken the unusual step of speaking my mind on this particular race.
And Maria Pappas was on my Politics Tonight evening show, and she said, and you've kind of indicated this too, she goes, look, it's hard to put it on Berrios because these problems have been around since post-World War II.
That's not true.
There have been some issues, but not like we've had.
Well, remember, everything is always a little more complicated than it sounds, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But that argument's been around forever. That kind of excuses Berrios, and that's not the case. The specific problem right now was discovered under Houlihan. They tried to fix it, passed on to Berrios, and basically over the last 7 years, he didn't do much, and then we found out what he did do failed, okay? So that's different than saying, oh, yes, because of powerful folks, even the fact that, you know, Ed Burke, nobody should be allowed to do what Ed Burke does. Because Ed Burke can represent Trump and all these other people. He can represent airlines, even though all of the airline legislation's got to go through the Finance Committee. See, these are things that wouldn't happen hardly in any other city.
Well, by the way, you can make the same argument, similar arguments for Mike Madigan, who also has a property tax firm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Madigan's a little more careful. But yes, in terms of the property tax stuff, Yeah, and you know, so the whole thing, I don't like to use real strong language, okay, pay to play and so forth, but the machine is a dangerous, outdated thing in which they were able to maintain this power by giving favors to some, which helped those individuals, but it didn't help the body politic. It didn't help the general populace.
So you haven't ventured into the governor's race at all, but under your theory, one could argue with J.B. Pritzker kind of having all sorts of support behind him. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, that's part of my theory. Again, no offense to J.B., but J.B. wouldn't be that serious a candidate except for the billions, okay? And the parties jumped all over him, okay, because they want somebody who's extremely wealthy, okay, not to say how their character is or whether or not they would be a good administrator, okay, but because of flat-out raw power and the fact that he's given millions and millions of dollars to hundreds of ward organizations across the state. Now, so the point is, I would say that battle's still going on there. I think that Daniel Biss and Chris Kennedy are both reformed Democrats, okay? Mm-hmm. And they're the ones, of course, on the outs. And the interesting thing is how it began to close, because the old party regulars thought they had it sold now with Pritzker. But see, nothing against J.D. I do not believe a democracy can function if billionaires can start advertising for themselves and a campaign a year and a half before an election, because nobody else can afford to do it. And I guarantee you, I can take the biggest scoundrel in the world and let them do, you know, 6 months of positive TV, and people will love them. And I can take a good person and the opposite, and people will hate them. So there's a lot of things wrong with our system, and that's why I don't buy into those. I'm not against the billionaire or millionaire, but I don't like the fact that, and it's the old-fashioned party, is just looking for someone that kind of protect Madigan and others.
You know, and I interviewed Tim Schneider, chair of the Republican Party, and he made an argument supporting the billionaire approach here, basically saying, look, when you don't have that, then you have candidates, Biss, Kennedy, whoever, who are accepting money from groups, and then you owe them something. So the Republican Tim Schneider chair approach was to say, you know what, at least Pritzker, Rauner, they don't owe anything to anybody.
No, that's total BS. No offense to Tim Schneider, but that's total BS. Look at Trump, for example. Billionaires owe people a lot. Okay, we talk about problems in government. Okay, one of the main differences between government and business is business has almost no rules. Okay, government, I can't have somebody fly me to Mexico for 2 weeks and wine and dine me. In business, they do that every day. Okay, of course they have debts. Just because they have money, that doesn't mean anything. Besides, I'd rather have someone who's out there raising smaller money, like, let's say, a Daniel Biss, because that means there's more people that believe in them. Okay, so yeah. I don't buy that notion that Trump uses or Rauner uses or Pritzker uses. No. And besides that, do we want to end up with a bunch of billionaires? Now, again, there could be extraordinarily qualified billionaires. But so far, most of the ones we're talking about are not.
Let me bring things home a little bit more to your world. ballot challenges. No, I love the conversation. This is great, and it's wonderful to hear you speak freely.
I've been speaking freely for a long time. I don't know that people understand that. If you go back, there's interviews I've done I did it all through the city council. I've been doing it since the early 90s. I mean, I remember the only reason I existed is not because I necessarily did good things. It's because I was mayor for a short time. That's the only reason I was able to win as county clerk. You can't win unless you're the machine candidate or lots of money.
Yeah.
And after they gave up trying to beat me, they kind of accepted me. That doesn't mean they like me. I get along with quite a few of the Democrats.
They just realize certain people are just always going to be around because people like them.
Right, or because they can win an election.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, I just want to ask you for a moment about the ballot battles. And what I mean by that is, look, your support Fritz Kagi in the assessor's race, and of course, Berrios is doing everything he can, interestingly enough, to keep Andrea Raylan, and this word is going to, word on that's going to come out in another day or so about her being on the ballot or not. But the thing is, doesn't everybody play that game? Kagi's trying to get her knocked off because he wants to take Berrios on one-on-one. I get the politics of it all, but isn't that what bothers you too, the politics of it all? As clerk, don't you want to say, you know what, just let people be on the ballot and let people decide? Even everybody's playing that game of knock so-and-so off to set me up to win.
Well, I agree. I do not. I wish we didn't have nearly as many challenges, okay? And I do think sometimes our petition requirements are too high. That just makes it more difficult. And I've said before, incumbents tend to challenge everybody. But you can't make an absolute there, okay? Because part of the problem, in some of these cases, there may be legitimate reasons. For example, there's people that bring in referendums, and they could be powerfully important ones, and they got 30 signatures, and they need 300, okay? Should that get on the ballot? Or if you can actually prove some sort of fraud or some major mistake. So the point is, this particular time, some things have gotten pretty hot. But remember, the vast majority of those cases were handled weeks ago, and were handled because they were fairly simple. Just do they have enough signatures or not?
Right.
So, again, I told you the other day that our passage of the automatic voter registration and our joining ERIC, which is states that share data, is going to have a dramatic improvement to help the candidates, because so many people who sign petitions have moved since they're registered. And that is not fair, and I do have some ideas of how we can fix that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if you can fix that, then you can dramatically reduce the number of challenges, and that's what I'm looking for. Still legitimate challenges, because people do things wrong, but a lot of them, perhaps, are not necessary.
I should ask you about this as we get ready for elections. It takes it to the national issue, but the whole Russian hacking thing, we talked about it on television. But, you know, listen, Illinois was one of the targets. They hit us. And so what's to say they don't still have their, tentacles in our system? How worried are you about getting hacked?
Well, I'm, again, I don't know if you've seen, but we're one of the most active counties in the nation. I mentioned the name of Noah Prates the other day, my director of elections. Okay, he's actually in Washington right now, meeting with Homeland Security and some other people. We have taken a very active stance. We are taking the attitude, we'll probably be hacked at some point. So what are all the things we can do? We've been working with Homeland Security and FBI for more than a year, because they do have experts. So even though the president is messing everything up, there are people in various government agencies that are being helpful. And they can help agencies like ours or other county clerks with risk assessment, trying to figure out, because we all assume the Russians will, they were successful, they will continue to do it more. Now, of course, here in Illinois, they just hacked the state board elections, voter or the registration base. But still, there's a lot of nasty things that could be done. So I'm concerned, but remember, when it comes to recreating the ballot, if something did happen in Cook County, okay, we have, number one, a paper record of everything on the touchscreen of electronic voting, which is popular.
So if there's a challenge of an election is too close.
That's right. So we have all that paper, okay, the paper on the electronic voting and the paper ballot. We also do something that almost no one in the country does. It's called forensic testing. It's basically you're taking a snapshot. It's high tech, but you're taking a snapshot of all the software as you prepare the ballot, because we do a lot of lab preparations at our warehouse. Okay, both when we're preparing the ballot before election day, on election day, and after election day, and we believe that would give us an indication if anyone had tried to put malicious software into our system. And that's something we've been doing now, I don't know, probably 5 or maybe 7 or 8 years. Okay, and I do believe the feds are impressed with that.
Right.
And we've been working with Congressman Quigley. I'm meeting with Schneider next week, the press conference with him, because we are kind of stepping out on this, because we know we need federal help. We need some dollars. I have a bigger office, but there's a lot of my colleagues around the state, around the country, that have 3 people in their office. So we need to make sure that everybody can get kind of the technical assistance. Because, yes, of course they'll try again.
Right. Hey, but I got to ask you, you just said Schneider. You mean Brad Schneider, Congressman Schneider, or did you mean Tim Schneider?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Congressman Schneider.
Yeah, well, you said Quigley, so I assume you meant Congressman Schneider as well. Hey, I'm just about out of time, but you know what? I've just completely gotten rid of my initial agenda for our discussion. So this is a more interesting discussion. But I do want to ask you, so 2019, Rahm probably goes for his third term. Maybe Gary McCarthy is in play. Maybe Paul Vallis. Do you have any stakes on what you want to see? Do you want Rahm serving another third term? Do you have any thoughts about it yet?
Well, I have lots of thoughts. In other words, I think we could do much better. I don't blame Rahm for all of our problems. Daley nearly bankrupted the city, even though Daley's better liked than Rahm. But Rahm is way too much the inequality mayor. He's way too much the helping the insiders and their friends and so forth. I can't tell you a person right now. I want someone who kind of goes back in some ways to the Harold Washington. By that I mean that doesn't believe in machine politics, that understands inequity is really serious, that you have to negotiate successfully with business, okay? But if you give away the store to them, there will not be enough money in your town to help those who need it. So there's a balance that I don't think we have. And that's what I'm looking for in a mayor that is committed to understanding these are the key things along with racism that we have to face. If we face them, Chicago is a giant city with enormous resources, and frankly, we have other cities that led by progressive mayors that seem to be doing better. So I believe the bar could be much higher. It's a little early to say, and certainly not Mr. McCarthy, who seems to be running on a pro-police.
Paul, but what about Paul Vallis?
Well, Paul, I don't know. Paul is he's a strange bird. He's a strange bird. And in fact, he was a lot of exaggerations about his ability with the schools. I mean, the schools never really improved much under him.
Although he's got some good turnaround stories from around the country. Would you like to see a progressive alderman, a Scott Wagaspack, a Rick Munoz, somebody like that?
Well, I would love to see someone, okay, that could become mayor, Scott Wagaspack, for example. He's extraordinarily talented. He's a bright guy. But whether it's a Scott or whether it's someone we're not talking about yet, I would love to see it. But again, if we, I'm calling we, those of us who see ourselves in one of the progressive wing of the party, if we're successful in winning the assessor's race with Rich Kagi, for example, and possibly if even Pritzker does not end up being the nominee, because I'm not sure if he could win in November, there's a few other things going on. I think that gives a jolt. And again, I'm not trying to wipe out these people. I want them to change from the old ways, have an open, transparent, reform-type party. Then I think we can make a lot more progress in Illinois because we've been losing steam. Even though we elect some of these people, we're losing hearts and minds.
They say if you want something done right, do it yourself. So I guess I will more seriously ask it than I did when we began. But is it something you'll consider? Are you going to give me a Sherman-esque close the door, or is it something we might see David Orr do, run for mayor?
I do not think you'll see that. I don't close the door on anything, but I don't think you'll see that. But I do plan, when I'm out of office, to be quite active politically.
Yeah, I don't think we've seen the last of you.
No, not.
and I tell you what, we have a mutual friend who asked me to ask this question, because when we talked about you, she said, that guy could write a book, so I'll ask. You going to write a book?
Probably. I have lots of stories, and I obviously have lots of opinions on things.
Yeah.
I like to think of myself more as public policy, so I don't want just a bunch of anecdotes. But I've got some things in mind. I've written a couple articles that I haven't really put out yet. Because I think it's very important. I teach some here at school in Chicago, in graduate school, and it's really important that people understand politics. Because when they don't, often you're blaming the wrong people if you don't understand what's really going on. And that happens all the time because both of our major parties want to convince you of something. And if they can distort, like with commercials, they will do that. So yeah. I do think that's important. And I do have things to say. And I have a lot of little cute, I've got this one that's going to be headline. It's going to be Ed Vidoliak. What's Orr been smoking? That's the headline. Okay. I got a ton of those things that have, each of them has a story behind it. So.
Well, I'll tell you what, when it comes out, you have the first invitation from me, television, podcast, wherever you want to join me, let's talk about it. As you said, some of these things reminded me, Dick Simpson, when his memoir just came out, he came on and we talked about that and filled with all sorts of, I assume you've read Dick's book already.
Well, I actually haven't, but, Dick was kind of my mentor. And they gave me his city council, which was the worst office in city council. but that's part of the old.
Well, he's got some secrets in his book. Secrets in his book too. You ought to check it out.
He does. No, well, he's a good friend.
Well, I read it, so yeah, it was great. Hey, Cook County Clerk David Orr, thank you for your candor. Thank you for your time. We didn't talk about anything we were supposed to, and that's the way I love it best.
Okay.
Thank you,
stay
David.
Careful.
All right, be well. Talk to you soon. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
He'll love where the wild things are.
I remember that one.
sort of scary pictures, right? Like monsters.
But Max stepped into his private boat and waved goodbye and sailed back over a year and in and out of weeks and through a day and into the night of his very own room.
You know the whole thing?
No, just the relevant passages.
Relevant to what?
I don't know. As a kid, I couldn't figure out why, after defeating the wild things and becoming their king, Max decides to go back home.
But you wouldn't have gone back home?
Absolutely not.
No, me neither.
Well, that is a small piece of an incredible show that is playing right now at Timeline Theater Company over on Wellington Avenue. I've seen it. Yeah, you have until March 18th to see it. It is called Boy by Anna Ziegler. And I had heard great things about it, but then I saw it. It knocked my socks off, and I said, I have got to talk to some of the folks involved in this so we can share this with other folks. So I will welcome to the podcast. First of all, one of the most amazing performances I've seen, and I'm just going to say, if you don't get a Jeff Award, then somebody's been robbed here. But Theo Germain, who plays Adam, welcome to the podcast. You are amazing in this.
Thank you.
And Steph Tovar, who you've heard recently when we talked about Christmas Schooner, he plays the dad in this show. I guess one of the hardest working actors in Chicago. Steph, good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you as well.
All right. And directing this show, lots of information to share about how we got this all together. Damon Kiley, who does great work anyway. And then, boy, I'm so glad you were on board with this. Damon, welcome to the podcast. I appreciate it. It's our first time with you.
I'm glad to be here.
So let me start. First of all, we heard that little clip. And this is a story about a boy named Adam and a girl named Jenny and parents and things they've gone through. But the thing is, there is so much more to this. It's almost difficult to know where to start, because to me, this is a story about love. It's a story about complexity, about relationships, gender identity, the consequences. It's amazing. So let me just start with you, if I can, Damon. Just fill our listeners in as to what this story is about and the fact that it is based on a true story.
Great. Absolutely. Well, first off, we definitely should know that it's a work of fiction. It takes its own, twists and turns. But it is definitely loosely based on the story of David Reimer. David Reimer was a young boy who had a twin brother. And in 1968, there was a botched circumcision with David. And the parents at the time were sort of just didn't know what to do. They didn't know where to turn. They felt like they had no answers. And they happened to see a TV show with a doctor, this Dr. Money, and he was someone who was sort of specializing in gender identity and things like that. And he had the theory at the time that gender could be learned as opposed to innate. And he also had a very, very strong belief in the binary, that either you were a boy or a girl, there was nothing in the middle. A lot of these ideas are things that many people don't believe anymore. But he believed them strongly, and he offered them this idea, and to them it really felt like a life raft. Listen, let's raise your kid as a girl. Don't ever change the name. We'll have a small surgery now, have another surgery down the line. Don't ever tell this person. Raise him as a girl, and everything will be fine. And as is not surprising, it did not turn out well. Really, from the beginning, David didn't feel comfortable in dresses, didn't want to play with girls' toys. And there's a long story, but the end of the story there is that, they finally told David, and David transitioned. I mean, I remember one thing about the story was that David said, once he found out what the real story was, he's like, oh, my God, I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
And they felt, I see why everything is the way it is. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I wanted to kind of stop you before you might get to the end of the show or how it ends, because I want to kind of talk about that specifically, and I sense you might be doing that. So let me hold off on that. But Theo, I want to come to you because you have had a journey in your own life. And, I greatly respect actors, and I think that, any actor can play any role, assuming they're talented and all of that kind of thing. But your journey in life is different than the character Adam or than David's was, but in some ways you had related challenges in growing up. Can you share with listeners a little bit about how you step into this role, given your own world?
Sure. So I was assigned female at birth. Like, as far as I know, I have, like, X to X chromosomes or whatever. But from a pretty early age, and this is not something that is true for all trans people, I experienced pretty strong gender dysphoria as a toddler, which is pretty much like nobody really told me that anything was wrong with me, or that I was supposed to be one gender or the other, or some or a different gender. But I was like, hey, I think something's wrong with like my place in society. I don't really feel like, I remember my mother telling me, like, oh, when you grow up, like, your body's going to look this way and your dad's body looks that way. And it was like a very healthy talk, but I was like, wow, something's really wrong with that. Like, I don't think that's who I want to be when I grow up. I did live the first 18 years of my life. I'm in my 20s now. As a girl, but in high school and middle school, like around the same time, by coincidence, around the same time that David, that the real life David and the fictional Adam started to have the worst problems with dysphoria and with not fitting into the role that they were being given. I was experiencing that really strongly too, and I didn't really get to start transitioning socially until I was 18 or 19, and actually moved from a place of using masculine pronouns to using he pronouns, and then after a couple years, I switched to using they, gender neutral, because I was like, wow, I actually don't think that I am either of these roles in society. I think that there's something else going on.
So, but I'm just curious, as I said, actors are actors. So do you, actually, I'm going to pop back and Steph, I'm going to come to you in just a moment. But Damon, let me just ask you, in casting the role, was having an actor who had anything like the life experience that Thea was had, was that important or did that not matter? Was it something that just, hey, that just came with the process?
Well, I would say that one of the people who is a real hero for this particular production at Timeline is Josie Kearns. Josie Kearns was the dramaturg and gender consultant on the show, and has been involved with Timeline for over a decade. And she is a transgender female, and she is someone who felt passionately about this show and very much saying, like, hey, this is not a trans story. Both Adam and David Reimer's stories are not trans stories, but they are trans adjacent. And she made the strong argument to say, you know, I really don't think that you should look at anyone who's not from the trans community for that lead part. And, you know, there was a lot of discussions, but the short version of it is that, you know, I came around to her way of thinking. The original production in New York was not done this way. The original production in New York was done with this gender dude. But we felt that was not really, you know, being honest to what the part was. You know, but I also want to make very clear, and I've made this very clear in other places, the reason Theo Germain's playing this part is because they are amazing.
Yeah.
And they're fantastic in the part, and they're a brilliant actor who, I think, as Theo just said, one of the things that Theo has to offer is a clearer understanding of Adam's childhood than many, many, many other actors would have. And so that, to me, was a great reason why to look for to consider only trans artists for this part, and then obviously in this case we just found the most perfect person in the universe for this part.
And you articulated exactly the way I was feeling about this. So Theo, congratulations with those comments, and I echo them. Yeah. Okay, Steph, let's go to the dad. Because Steph, listen, I think you're the consummate dad in Chicago theater, right? This is just if you need a dad. But here's the thing. You in this role, you're a dad, but you are, you know, you're a boy's dad, you're the man's man, all this kind of stuff. Talk to me about how you enveloped this character in dealing with the challenges that the character, the father, has to play in this role, and how that impacted you, if it did, personally at all, or how easy it was to do this.
That's a good question. You know, I think being a parent in general, and I know we talked about this in the rehearsal process, and the people that, the Reimers, the actual people that these two characters are based on, the mom and the dad, Doug and Trudy in the play, I think we as parents just try to do the best we can, and we're constantly calling audibles every single day, and we make mistakes. And I think the two parents in real life of the Reimers, you know, they really didn't have another choice. And at the time, they made the best choice that they thought would help their son. It turned out to not be a good choice, but ultimately. But at the time, with all the information they had, they did the best they could. And I think as parents, I can relate to, you know, every day we get up and we make the best choice we can for our kid, and we hope that we do it right. And some days are more successful than others. And then also, you know, my son is going to be 12 next month, and just kind of taking every day and letting him be who he is and who he's and become who he's becoming. I think I can really relate to that, and I can relate to Doug's journey in the play in terms of just seeing his son for who he is. And, you know, there's this just beautifully written scene towards the end of the play between the two of them that the writing really, you know, takes care of itself. Yeah. I'm so lucky to be a part of it.
Theo, let me talk about the relationship between Adam and Jenny a little bit, because every scene I watch in that show between Adam and Jenny, certainly during the, you know, the first part of it when he's being asked to live as a girl and all that kind of thing, it's such a complex performance because, and maybe it's just me, but I see in your face you are being who it is you have to be, but you also seem to be struggling with the person it is you are being told to be.
Do you mean in the scenes, the flashback scenes, or?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't mean towards the end of the show, but I mean just sort of like after you kind of come to a realization, Adam comes to a realization at one point that this is, you know, living as a girl is not who he is. He wants right. this relationship, but there's this internal struggle that to me shows on your face throughout. And I think it's very powerful.
The relationship with
Jenny, doctor. With Jenny.
Oh, with Jenny. I think that there's this thing that there's something that I think happens at the beginning, like an observation. After the show's over, an observation that I have about myself. I think that the first time that Adam and Jenny run into each other, it's something that the audience might not pick up on, but they went to grade school together.
Right.
Before Adam was able to live as the gender he is. And so I think at the beginning, they run into each other, and he's like just like overwhelmed and excited by this person who he really just like was kind of in love with when he was growing up, running into her. I think that like, he forgets that, I don't know what I'm trying to say. He feels this excitement that I think he felt the first time he ever saw her mm-hmm. when he was living as a girl.
Right.
And I think that there's this thing happening where some walls are coming down, but they're also coming up at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Where he wants to live in this like pure, wonderful, innocent, like love, romantic space with her, but because of his life, and because of it being 1989 and because of, you know, him transitioning when he was 15 or 16, he can't just be open with her and say everything that he wants to say, even though he desperately wants to.
And that's the conflict I'm kind of referring to, because you feel that as an audience member. You're watching this, and of course, there is a moment where Adam clarifies for Jenny that they do have this past. And you know, you realize first she didn't know, and then she comes to realize exactly what's been going on.
Right.
So
throughout the play, through their relationship that they start to develop, it's kind of like he's not lying.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also several things that he is just the most terrified in the world of saying because of rejection.
Yeah.
You know, because of his life being so distraught, he's not he's not really had any relationships before, and he has all these ideas of love and romance and marriage, and there are all these things that he wants, but he's never, ever experienced it, anything close to it at all. You know, so he's very, like, childlike at the same time in the way he goes about some of these things.
He's so young.
Yeah.
Damon, so let's get to the part that I'm not going to spoil anything. I'm going to put it in your hands. The play ends differently. The play ends differently than real life. I will say that. Let me also say this. I tend to do a lot of my research and reading after I see a show. I just kind of want to take the show in without any preconceptions, or I read this, or I know what's coming. So the play ends very well. This I can say. It ends very uplifting. I mean, I'm like, oh yay, Adam and Jenny, they kind of work it out. They're going to get this together. Real life doesn't end that way, and I'm going to let you decide whether or not you want to disclose that to folks or not. That doesn't matter. But how important was it that the play end in that positive way, as opposed to perhaps what happened in real life?
Well, I think that, you know, I don't think we can need to shy away from a little bit of controversy around it. There are certainly some people who say, hey, you're not telling the full story here. David Reimer committed suicide, which he did. And many trans people do. 2006. That it's, you know, it's a very high percentage, you know, much higher than the rest of the population and cisgender population. And so some people did say, and in fact, there were some in the trans community, I will say, who said, I cannot sign on to being a part of the show. And we respected that. I know that Anna felt like two things when she was writing it. One, it's a piece of fiction. The character's name is Adam, the doctor's, all the names are changed.
Right.
And that she felt like in her fictional universe, she thinks that her Adam does not commit suicide. She thinks that Adam does, you know, end in this happy place and sort of try to change things. And so she was trying to imagine a different, more hopeful world in some ways, I think. The other way to look at it, if you're an audience member, is this did happen in some ways. David Reimer did meet someone who was the love of his life. He did adopt three kids. They did have, like, 8 years, something like that, of a happy marriage. But there were a lot of things there. And, in fact, in some weird way, it's possible, one of the twists of the story in real life is that Reimer was actually sort of living happily with his wife, not knowing that Dr. Money was still out in the world telling his story, but telling a lie version of it. Like he's saying, like, oh, it all worked out. You know, the patient stayed a girl, and it was all great. And it wasn't until someone tracked David Reimer down and said, "You know, this is happening." Is that that's when David Reimer went public? And some people speculate that going public was a thing that kind of started to like disintegrate his life. We don't know for certain,
right?
But I guess my take on it is that we felt that, and I'll say one last thing, which is that timeline is such a place that has such integrity. All of that information is laid out super clearly in the program book and online. I mean, just like the complete details of what happened there. And so, to me, I'd say that the play is trying to tell a complicated story about love, about gender, about family, using a real-life thing as a launching pad. And then the timeline gives you the rest of the story to delve deeper, and hopefully people will delve deeper.
And so you put it out there. So that's great. In fact, we learn other things as you actually read the materials that his twin, Adam's twin brother, dies of a drug overdose.
Yeah.
So this was a procedure, things that went on in this family that were very difficult for everybody to go through. Steph, back to you in the father role. I'm just curious, when you think about this, because this is a fictional role based on a real character, and I realize you're directed to a lot of this, but in your own interpretation, your own decisions about playing Doug, did you think about what the real Mr. Reimer would have been like? Or did you say, no, I'm playing this fictional guy? What went into your process for creating the role?
Well, I think if you're playing someone that is based on a real person, you have to take that into consideration. Obviously, the ridiculous mustache that I have to wear in real life.
You know, I didn't want to say anything. I was going to compliment you.
But I have it because the dad had that mustache. But at the end of the day, you pull from your own experiences. And, you know, my dad was very similar to Doug in the play. And I think I sort of channel him at times. So I think you just kind of take it all and also listen to what the play is telling you and what your director is telling you as well. And that's, you know, kind of what came up.
Theo, when you think about future roles you want to play, this to me, again, is so incredible and so powerful. What decisions do you take into the process of selecting a role? So I don't know what's up next for you. Maybe you've got one. You can tell us. But what do you think of when you're picking a role that you want to play?
I think that's kind of complicated for me to answer because I think in the acting world, I actually kind of exist in the space that is in between the genders that are primarily recognized by, like, casting and things like that. And so I put a lot of thought. I usually, if I see a season, I'm like, what could I potentially be called in for? And I don't really ever know because I'm not really ever sure how I'm read because it's always different. I will say, like, casting companies, like, I've done a lot of Shakespeare, and I've done, like, all the fairies, you know, and I'm working on a production at Chicago Shakespeare Theater this summer, and I'm going to be playing, you know, a mystical being. I think there's the tendency to, like, put trans people into those roles, which is, like, fun, but, like, being humans is nice. I think that what I will say is this show has definitely felt like a turning point for me where I'm like, I really believe if there's something I want to go after, I'm like, I know that I have the strength to do it. And I know that I can present myself in the room and be like, hey, you know, this is slightly a different option. This kind of might be a wild card, but like you should pick me or you should take a chance on me because I will be able to deliver, and I don't think that's something that I always kind of was able to believe in about myself. I also don't get to play men very often. Sometimes I've gotten to play like 6-year-old boys, which is fun in its own way. but I've played a lot of women, even when I've not really wanted to, because I've been. That sometimes that's been the only work that I've been able to get because folks are like, oh, we could call this person for that, but, like, we don't believe that it could be male.
Which has to be, I don't know if it's frustrating or angering to you. I don't know. I kind of get angry when I hear that kind of thing, that you know, people have those issues, but I guess that's part of the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, I like acting, and I want it to be my job, and so I want to get hired, and I want to, like, know what my, you know, I want to know what my place is, but I also want to challenge that. I think that there was definitely a lot of frustration that I used to feel, and now I'm just like, all right, frustration, challenge accepted, I'll just work 10 times as hard as everyone else I have to prove to them that, like, I can do this just like other people can.
Yeah. Well, I did, by the way, see you, I should mention, I saw you as Minnie in Matchmaker at the Goodman.
Right? And it was the complete opposite. That was the first professional thing I'd ever done. And I was like, wow, Steph was actually my coach for that. Steph actually like, helped me get that job, which was awesome.
I love it. Well, by the way, if you're free at Christmas time, Steph can probably have you deliver Christmas trees from Michigan back to Chicago. Talk to him about that. He'll make that happen. And let me just we'll kind of close things off here as I come to you, Steph. What is next for you? Another dad role, I'm imagining this has to be one of the most interesting roles your career is going to see. With all due respect,
you know what? It's been great. It's definitely different for me, and I'm having a great time doing it. And the process was incredible. Damon really created a collaborative room for everyone. So I'm going to be sad when this is over. I don't actually know what's next. I do a lot of on-camera coaching and acting coaching, and that's been keeping me very busy. And I'm directing a web series in April, and, you know, we'll see what happens next.
All right. Well, I'm available if you want to cast me in the web series. I'm always available. That kind of thing. And Damon, sorry, go ahead.
That sounds great.
All right. I'll take it. See, Theo, that's how you do it. You put yourself out there, and you just say, I'm here.
I'm learning how to do that.
and Damon, I know next up is, I think, is To Catch a Fish, at which you're not directing. I know O.J. Parson is directing that. But what is up next for you?
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm opening DePaul's season in the fall with Qui Gwen's She Kills Monsters.
Yeah.
Which is But I know, I'm very excited about
it. I love that play.
The whole school kind of freaked out. It's a sort of great play in which people sort of delve into these Dungeons & Dragons characters and get to, like, slay dragons and orcs and nutty things like that. And it's also but a beautiful story between the two sisters. So, yeah, I can't wait.
You're just tapping into Shape of Water, aren't you?
That's right. Exactly.
That works. Well, I got to tell you, as I said, people have until March 18th to see this over at Timeline Theater. Just such a great show. As I said, I walked out there and immediately contacted the PR people. And I said, I got to talk to these folks because I congratulate all of you, Theo. An incredible performance, and I can't wait to see the next thing that you do. And Steph, of course, always the same with you and Damon as well. You can get tickets at timelinetheater.com. Theater spelled T-R-E the correct way, in my opinion. The way they do it in London, and I want to thank you guys for your time, for sharing, and for just and congratulate Anna Ziegler too. I guess she should get a little credit here, right? She wrote the thing, but it's just such a wonderful production. I look forward to chatting with you again on another production. Thank you guys. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.